times. I'm Artie Moscowain. If you can get out of the city and suburbs, find a place where there are no streetlights, no highways or houses, and look up at the night sky, it's a marvelous sight. Our guest, astronomer Chris Impey, has spent countless hours looking at and thinking about how the cosmos came to be. His new book, How It Began, A Time Traveler's Guide Through the Universe, takes readers back billions of years to the Big Bang. He joins us on Radio Times to take a journey through time and space. He's a university distinguished professor in the astronomy department at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's actually on sabbatical at Princeton University, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Chris, it'd be nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yes, great to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. So is there a sky, a memorable sky for you? Sky experience?
Yes, Tucson is great, but actually my favorite sky, an astronomer's not supposed to play favorites with the sky, but Chile, where we build our biggest telescopes, is incredible. The observatories in the northern part of the populated Chile and the southern Atacama Desert, and there's no village for maybe 300 miles. And the first time I went there, I was getting ready for a night's observing, just gathering my stuff, stepped outside, got a little dark adapted, and I noticed that the folder I had in my hand was casting a shadow by starlight. The stars were so bright. And then I tilted my head up and my jaw dropped, and I thought, I have never seen anything like that. It's like someone with a dial had just cranked it up much beyond what you would normally see. An amazing sky.
And I guess thinking about all these telescopes that allow us to see farther into the universe, I guess farther back in time as well, should we think of telescopes as time travelers or helping us be time travelers?
It's a pretty good analogy because, time travel is a science fiction concept, but telescopes actually do that because light does not travel at infinite speed. We look out and therefore we look back. Now, astronomers haven't figured out
how to... Which I love. I love that whole concept.
Now, we can't look forward in time. So, unfortunately, astronomers haven't got that trick. But the looking back just happens naturally. So, the bigger your telescope, the further out you look, the further back in time we look. And the goal is just to follow that thread all the way back to the beginning.
And how far back are we today?
Well, with the best optical telescopes and the Hubble Space Telescope, we've gone back about 13 billion years in a 13.7 billion year old universe. So we've gone about 95% of the way back.
And is there an easy way to describe the universe? I mean, can you describe the universe for us?
That is hard. It's a whole lot of nothing for the most part because space is, phenomenally empty. The average density of space is about 10 billion billion times less dense than the air we're breathing. So it's an almost perfect vacuum. And then scattered through that void are galaxies. But there are big spaces between them. And then astronomers also believe that the universe is filled with two quantities we don't quite understand, dark energy and dark matter. But they're very thinly distributed, too. So vacuum is a pretty good approximation to the universe.
You also say, and I wrote this down, that the universe, quote, mocks us with its secrets. So while there's much more that we know about the universe, there's mostly we don't know about the universe.
Yeah, astronomy is, I would still say, a young science. It really kicked off with Galileo and the telescope 400 years ago. We've taken it a lot further this century, last past century, with big telescopes. But, when we don't understand the two major ingredients of the universe, dark energy and dark matter, we can't really say we understand everything.
I actually shared this yesterday on the Facebook page just about how ignorant I am about science, but nonetheless, here we are on the air. But you do write about dark energy and dark matter. So there's an inkling of understanding about how these work.
Well, we see their effect is probably the better way to put it. So we live in an expanding universe, and the universe seems to have a brake and an accelerator. And the brake is dark matter because gravity always tugs on other things, and so that's slowing down the expansion. But there also seems to be this component called dark energy, which is causing the universe to accelerate in its expansion. So it goes opposite gravity.
Right.
We don't understand that very well at all. And these are the two forces, if you like, that govern the expanding universe.
But how do we know they exist?
The dark matter we know from a variety of threads of evidence. Basically, galaxies would just fly apart if they weren't held together by something that we're going to call dark matter that outnumbers the normal particles we're made of by a factor of 7. The evidence for dark energy is a little more slender, and it's really just based on the fact that the expansion is going faster and faster with time.
And that was your previous book was about that, was it not, in part?
Yes. So that's what happens to a universe that's endlessly expanding, you know. And I hope that I didn't leave an impression, even with myself, that it's a bleak scenario. Right. Because a lot of interesting things can happen in a universe that just keeps expanding forever.
And we're yes. And these notions of nothingness and forever, I mean, they're so inscrutable in a way, and so provocative.
As with beginnings, because in some sense it's more comfortable to think that there wasn't a beginning. Because as soon as you postulate a beginning, then the question logically is, well, what was before?
Exactly.
What caused everything to happen? And astronomers don't really know how to answer that question. So in a sense, it's easier conceptually to just say, just was here forever. And most ancient cultures in the world had an endless view of time.
We're talking about the Big Bang. That was, quote-unquote, the beginning of the universe.
That's the scientific theory of creation, and it's supported by quite a lot of evidence now. And the most telling piece of evidence is space is permeated with a very diffuse radiation that's basically microwave, so it's very low energy. And that has the perfect properties to be the leftover radiation from an early hot, dense state. Mm-hmm. So we see evidence of the Big Bang, even though it happened all those billions of years ago, in radiation we can measure with radio telescopes now.
You also write about the Belgian monk that, I guess, began the thinking of this Big Bang, and it goes back almost 100 years ago, I guess, to the early 20th century.
Yes, and that, as just a sidelight on cosmology, it's interesting how often priests have played a role in influential theories. I work at my University of Arizona with the Jesuit priests and astronomers at the Vatican Observatory, and they've been in charge of keeping the calendar, of course, since the time of Galileo, but also they do research. And the Jesuits in particular have this very interesting tradition where they're absolutely free to think about big thoughts like the Big Bang, and it doesn't conflict with their faith or their beliefs. And so Lemaître, Georges Lemaître, a Belgian priest, you know, he essentially came up with the first concept, and Einstein eventually paid him great accolades for having had that idea.
And what was the idea? I mean, what was he thinking?
He was just thinking that since Hubble had shown that the universe was expanding, Hubble didn't speculate about the beginning, but Lemaître took Hubble's observation and said, well, if you run this clock backwards, then everything must have been all together in one place, and that therefore must have been hot. And he called it a day without a yesterday, and said that we should be able to see the fireworks left over from the early hot state, the singularity, he even called it. And so he was very much ahead of his time, because we didn't get evidence for a Big Bang for decades.
And did he think of other things as well, or was this his crowning achievement?
This was his major contribution. He ended up actually being he elevated through the ranks to be the head of all Jesuits in the world. So he had quite a high position within the Catholic Church. He was also bon vivant. He used to maybe love his whiskey a little too much and food. And so he had many other pleasures beyond cosmology.
But we're talking about something that happened almost 14 billion years
ago. That's right.
We know that with some degree of certainty.
Well, we can project it. It's a calculation, because we see the expanding universe, and you can just essentially, like a movie, you can run that movie backwards and say, well, how long would you have to run that movie before everything was on top of everything else? And it's a pretty well-determined number.
And are there other universes? I know there are some debate about this.
Other universes is at the cutting edge,
yes,
the bleeding edge, if
yes,
you like, of cosmology. And that's pretty much pure speculation. And it sort of relates to this issue of, if once you have an origin, you're tempted to ask, well, right, what came before? And people trying to answer that what came before question have hypothesized that our universe emerged from a construct where other universes could have emerged in parallel to ours, but unobservable by us, and that's the
yes,
catch. That means it's not really testable at the moment as a scientific idea.
So you don't buy it, or you're just saying we don't have enough evidence yet?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a skeptic, because I'm an observer, and so, you know, when a theorist, you know, takes me out and tries to persuade me of the multiverse, I sort of say, well, okay, what am I going to look at with my telescope? And then the conversation sort of dries up, because there's no predictions at the moment. But that's not to say they're not working on that. So it's a young theory, and I'd say give it some time. They might come up with things we can look for.
And when that happens, when you're taken out, are we talking about, you know, In the alley behind the bar having some discussion?
No, theorists are not usually muscular and threatening, so this is usually a genteel academic debate.
But a good one, I mean, to just imagine or think about you know, either other universes or that moment before the Big Bang or what existed before the Big Bang, I would assume that that's all good fodder.
Definitely. And for a long time, astronomers just didn't speculate. They just were very rigorous and said, look, the Big Bang just describes what happened since, but doesn't say anything about what happened before or why. And now cosmologists are being a little more ambitious, and they're trying to ask the before and the why questions. And I think it's a good thing to do. Why not?
And does it also raise questions about other life forms? I mean, not necessarily other human beings, but other life forms somewhere, maybe even in our own universe?
Oh, absolutely. The scope of the universe we live in is phenomenal. So we now have measurements with Kepler telescope and other ground-based observatories that can pretty much project how many habitable worlds there are in the Milky Way, just our galaxy, where habitable world means something that's sort of Earth-like, not in detail, but, you know, could have water, could have energy, could have biology. And that's 100 million in one galaxy. And then, because cosmologists have told us and pretty much measured that there are 100 billion galaxies in the universe, you multiply 100 billion by 100 million, and it's hard to do in your head, but it's a big number. It's billions of trillions of habitable worlds.
Billions of trillions of habitable worlds.
In the universe. And so, logically, either they're all dead and we're it. That seems very unlikely. It's possible, of course. It's possible. Or the universe is teeming with life, and then you have a different problem, which is, why haven't we seen it yet? Or maybe life is rare, or especially intelligent life is rare. So the possibilities in that range are pretty amazing, but the raw material is this phenomenal number of billions of trillions of habitable worlds with plenty of time for something interesting to happen on them. 13 billion years. So you could have an Earth somewhere else that had an 8 billion year head start on our planet, and where would it have got to?
Sure. And water, I mean, you think water is a key to understanding habitable planets?
It's an assumption, and we have to be careful about what assumptions we put into the game. But it's not a hard assumption, because water is one of the most common molecules in the universe. It's actually fairly abundant. There are, we now think, about a dozen places in the solar system beyond the Earth where, in some places, maybe underground, under pressure, there's water. So if you just say you need water, you need energy, you need carbon material, there's tons of places in the universe where all those ingredients exist.
And ones you think human beings could get to, or who knows yet?
The solar system ones are the ones we can get to with our robots and maybe with astronauts. The ones in other star systems, that's a little tough, where our technology is a little not insufficient to deal with the star distance.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Chris Impey today on Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called How It Began, and it's subtitled A Time Traveler's Guide to the Universe, talking about the universe today on Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Also, opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with Continuously Controlled Damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
Supporting WHYY, Act 2 Playhouse presents the classic Broadway musical My Fair Lady. My Fair Lady features such memorable Lerner and Lowe songs as Wouldn't It Be Lovely, Get Me to the Church on Time, and I Could Have Danced All Night. Starring Tony Braithwaite as Henry Higgins, My Fair Lady, directed by Bud Martin, runs at Act Two Playhouse's intimate 130-seat theater in Ambler, April 24th through June 3rd. Tickets and information at act2.org or 215-654-0200.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has strengthened children and families. The Foundation supports nonprofit organizations that enhance parenting, mentor youth, create safe environments, advance individual education, and advocate for children and families. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or fellowfound.org.
supporting WHYY Fidelity Investments Bucks County Investor Center, located at 1520 Main Street in the Valley Square Shopping Center. Information at 1-800-FIDELITY or fidelity.com. Fidelity Brokerage Services, member NYSE SIPC.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with astronomer Chris Impey. He's got a new book that takes readers on a journey through time and space, beginning with our solar system, through the cosmos, and all the way back to the Big Bang. The book is called How It Began and includes descriptions and discussions about things like black holes, dark matter, multi-universes, M-theory, and much more. Chris Impey is a distinguished professor in the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and he's been on sabbatical at Princeton University, and he joins us here in Philadelphia, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's talk about some things a little bit closer to home here, which would be our solar system. And our solar system, as you describe, is formed through sort of a cloud of gas and dust. If you can expand on that.
Yeah, it's a kind of amazing story that we didn't fully understand until a couple of decades ago. So somehow a diffuse, huge cloud of gas and dust, where the dust particles are, you know, really tiny, a millionth of a meter, somehow forms a huge star and then eight rocky cinders called the planets and their moons. Yeah. And this all happened in, we think, about 30 or 40 million years. And that's out of a 4.5 billion year history. So it happens in the blink of an eye, basically. Yeah. And somehow material coagulates into little dusty crystals, you know, almost like snowflakes. And then gradually they join together until they form, you know, molehills. And then you get mountains and then you get planets. And so gravity is responsible for this. And it doesn't take that long to go from these tiny little dusty snowflakes up to something like the Earth.
And you're saying we don't know what, I guess, sparked the creation of our solar system?
That's right. So the question of why did this big woofly gas cloud collapse is up for grabs, except there's very interesting evidence. So outer solar system material like comets and asteroids are impregnated with a radioactive element that's only produced when stars die. So one nice supposition is that our star forming was caused by the death of a neighboring star, which is kind of a nice cycle of birth and death of stars. Given that we're all made of stardust anyway, so all of our heavy elements were produced in other stars, it's kind of elegant and symmetric to have our solar system and star forming by the death of yet another star.
And I know we are star systems, but in what can you describe that? In what way are we made of stars?
It's not even a metaphor, although obviously there's a nice song about that.
Yes, there is.
It's literal because carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen plus other heavy elements were not formed in the Big Bang. So this Big Bang theory we've been talking about only gives you hydrogen and helium, essentially, in your universe, the two simplest elements. All the higher elements in the periodic table are made inside the hearts of stars. And for them to get into our bodies, they had to be produced in distant stars long ago, at least 4.5 billion years ago, far off in space and time, and then assemble into a rocky cinder called the Earth and become part of our bodies. So each of those atoms has a story to tell, and the stories are different. Not every carbon atom in our bodies had the same path, and somehow they assembled into us. It's kind of extraordinary.
It's awesome, actually, when you think about it. You also quote something from Mark Twain's Huck Finn, where Huck Finn says, "We had the sky up there all speckled with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look up at them and discuss about whether they was made or only just happened." And these questions about the universe have inspired, you know, philosophers, writers, poets, others through the centuries.
Right. And Pascal, the philosopher, had probably the basic question, which is why is there something rather than nothing? Because nothing is easier than something.
Exactly.
The astronomer's version of that question would be, given a sort of chaotic or almost uniform early state, why do you have so much structure? Why do you end up with galaxies and stars and planets and people? And gravity is mostly responsible for that, but it's more than just gravity, because biology, to get biology, you obviously have to have a lot of more subtle interactions going on. So astronomers don't have a full answer to that question.
But when astronomers use the word chaos or things are chaotic, that doesn't mean necessarily what you know, us, the rest of us might mean. Or does it?
Well, a little bit. It does, right. It doesn't mean that you can't find anything and your room is a mess or your file system's a mess.
Exactly.
It's a physical state where there's a lot of disorder and everything's jumbled up and there's no structure. So it's best to think of it as a lack of structure.
Right.
And when we look at the now universe 13.7 billion years later, there's a lot of structure. There are beautiful spiral galaxies and star clusters and planets in particular orbits around their stars, and you just say, well, where did that all come from if the starting state was almost uniform or chaotic?
The planet that we have visited, obviously, is the moon, as you say, about a quarter of a million miles away, 250,000 mm-hmm. miles away. You describe it as a big rock.
Yeah. It's a very interesting rock, though, because we think the modern theory has that it formed from a giant impact of the Earth. So when the Earth was still almost tacky and molten very early on, when the rock was still hot, we hypothesize, or astronomers believe, it was hit by a Mars-sized object and the moon splashed off and formed in orbit around the Earth. Now, what we need to explain with the theory of the moon is, why is it so big compared
yes.
to the Earth, because it's a very big moon. We need to explain why it doesn't have a magnetic field and therefore doesn't have metals in the middle, whereas other objects that are moon-sized in the solar system have metals. And we also need to explain why it's in such a tight orbit of the Earth. This impact theory neatly explains all those three phenomena.
Wow.
And if we have moon rocks, of course, the benefit of having gone to the moon, although I guess some people think we didn't actually go. I mean, I do think we went.
No, I don't want to start
we won't
that.
Go there.
No, we won't go there.
So we did go. We did bring back rocks. And for any skeptics, of course, there's a place in Houston where you can look at the moon rocks. The moon rocks are the best evidence we have of this idea of the moon formation, because we can compare moon rocks in geological gory detail to Earth rocks, and they look like Earth mantle and crust
wow.
material.
Wow. But you also write about the influence the moon has had on calendars and tides and ceremonies. I mean, it drives so much, both I guess subliminal and actual, on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, it's got this presence that affects us. It's the basis of all timekeeping. So before we went to a solar calendar, which is only 2,000 years ago, most cultures around the world used the moon, you know, back through prehistory. And of course, Islamic culture still use the moon. So the moon is the basis of timekeeping for all time through human history.
Talking with astronomer Chris Impey today on Radio Times about the universe, I guess. That would be a fair description. And he's written a new book. It's called How It Began, A Time Traveler's Guide to the Universe. Excuse me, we have a full bank of calls. Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Looks like we have Eric from Bethlehem joining us on Radio Times. And Eric, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Marty.
Hi there.
And Chris, it's a great show.
Thank you.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
My question has to do with the Big Bang and the beginning of things. From what I understand, time is considered a fourth dimension. As there are three, then time is considered a fourth. And when you go all the way back to the very beginning of the Big Bang, none of these dimensions were, for lack of a better word, active, including time. So if that's the case, how does anything get started at all if you don't have time?
Great question,
yes.
Eric. Yeah, go ahead,
Eric,
Chris.
You've sort of cut to the chase of what cosmologists don't know. Exactly. I think Stephen Hawking has actually said the Big Bang theory and gravity theory contains the seeds of its own demise. And that's because the Big Bang theory does not explain the singularity, the initial state, when, as you say, how do you talk about time at the point where time starts? What does it emerge from?
Mm-hmm.
So the totally honest answer from cosmologists to that is that we don't know. We simply don't know. The theory runs out of steam as you get towards the Big Bang itself. Now, that doesn't stop ambitious cosmologists from trying to conjure up preceding states that out of which you might get multiple universes, for example. That's the multiverse theory. But I would say there's no theory that says where time emerges from. And even in the very early universe, I've had people ask me, well, you know, we measure time with oscillations of atoms. Atomic clocks is our best timekeeping. Well, how do you measure time, or what does it even mean before you have atoms?
Right.
And the answer is that really time measurement in the early parts of the theory is just a mathematical calculation. It doesn't necessarily have a physical meaning.
Eric, thanks for the call. Let me see what Helen from Helen McKenna has to say. And Helen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I've been on the show a couple of times. I work at the Edgar Allan Poe National Historic Site.
Oh, absolutely. Hi, Helen.
Hi. And I'm really enjoying the conversation.
Thank you
so
much.
I just wanted poor Edgar to, I'd like to understand how Edgar Allan Poe may fit into a cosmologist's understanding of the history of the development of the understanding of the Big Bang. I'm sorry if that was very verbose.
Yes.
Well, and I just have to say this is an astronomer, not a cosmologist, but nonetheless.
No, that's fine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So, Helen, I know what you're alluding to. Edgar Allan Poe, you know, in addition to being a great writer and a somewhat tortured individual, obviously, you know, was a great thinker. And he, in his writings, clearly alludes to a fundamental question that becomes the heart of understanding the modern universe, which is why is the night sky dark? So if you think of an infinite cosmology, which was the cosmology that Newton had before we knew of an expanding universe and before Hubble's observations, you imagine that the universe is filled with stars or galaxies or light, and since they go on forever, logically in any direction that you look, eventually you should see a light source, even if it's very far away. And because the light from each source goes down at the same rate that the number of sources goes up, that light should add up to infinite light. In other words, the night sky should be bright. And there's evidence that Poe understood the logic of this argument and was aware that the darkness of the night sky, which I'm sure he was happy to use metaphorically in his writing, had a deep physical implication.
Interesting. Helen, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Ted from Chester County has to say. And Ted, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question is about dark matter. Everything I hear about dark matter explains it by saying that the universe is expanding at a faster rate as it goes outward, and it should be slowing down due to gravity. And the reason why it's expanding, they say, is this force they don't understand called dark matter. My question is, if there's no gravity out there, why should it be slowing down?
Well, go ahead.
Okay, so
ahead. Thanks,
there are two ingredients in play here, and your question sort of alludes to both of them. There's dark matter and dark energy. The dark energy is what we think is causing the endlessly accelerating expansion. And that, truly, we don't understand. That in the only evidence for something we might call dark energy is the fact that the expansion is increasing with time. The dark matter, however, does have more evidence to support it. Any galaxy, including the Milky Way galaxy, if it were only made of the stuff that we see and all the stars we see, would fly apart. It would be a temporary or an evanescent thing. And same with other galaxies. And so the galaxies we see do have durability. They're there for billions of years. And if they can rotate and be held together, it must be by some dark material that has gravity but not light. And so that's really the basis for astronomers talking about dark matter. So that dark matter permeates not just galaxies but the universe at large. And in the universe at large, the dark matter does act to slow down the cosmic expansion. But in the present universe, the dark matter is sort of outmatched by dark energy, and that's why the universe seems to be accelerating.
Ted, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me segue from that to black holes, as you describe a region where gravity is so intense that light cannot escape. That seems like the running definition. But you also describe what it might be like to go inside of a black hole.
Right.
Can you do that?
Yeah, it's the classic black hole, which results from the death of a massive star, is not a place that any of us would want to ever go, because in that descent through into the abyss, you are essentially ripped apart by gravity in a quite unpleasant way. I don't want to talk about unpleasant things, but you would be pulled apart. The gravity on your toes would be so much more than the gravity on your head. You'd be pulled apart, and not like pizza dough, but pulled apart at the level of fibers and molecules. Spaghettified is the technical term. So that's a normal-sized black hole. However, if you find a nice massive black hole, and we think there's one in the center of our galaxy that's 4 million times the mass of the Sun, so this is a beast that is formed over billions of years and has the definition of a black hole. It's a large amount of mass where there's a region beyond which nothing can escape. But the gravity is a little gentler in its tugging or stretching effect. And so hypothetically, you could approach such a black hole and actually pass through the event horizon. You might feel mild discomfort, probably no more than like indigestion or something, as this tidal force affected you, but you could fall in. And Unfortunately, so we'd love to do the experiment. Scientists would love to know what's inside a black hole. This one is 28,000 light years away, and that's a little beyond our technology to get there.
Are you sorry that Pluto got kicked out?
I'm pretty hard-hearted on this
one.
Most astronomers are fairly unapologetic, and it's basically a choice. If you want to keep Pluto, then we've already found at least one and eventually probably five objects as big or bigger than Pluto in the outer solar system. So is it more cruel to third graders who are attached to Pluto and the cartoon character to take away one of their planets or make them remember five new things?
I think I know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But there was such a hoopla about that.
Yes. People were attached to Pluto. And so I think astronomers were a little naive in imagining there might not be a backlash from the demotion of Pluto. But, you know, astronomy has carried on, and really also it's interesting that the search for planets beyond our solar system has actually got to the point where some of those systems have eight planets. So we have planetary systems as rich as our own planetary system around other stars. So that whole game is, and nobody has to remember their names, thank goodness.
Well, let me ask you about Methuselah, and you write here, the Methuselah planet has no right to exist.
Right. So there's a story we like to tell about stars and planets, that since these heavy elements that have had their journeys through stars were created by generations of stars, in principle, if you go back through time, there should be a time before planets existed, or people, or biology, because there just wasn't enough carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, and other elements. So this planet was discovered just a few years ago that had its origin 11 or 12 billion years ago, and it just left people scratching their heads because there shouldn't have been enough grit in the universe to make planets that early. And when you find something like that that surprises you that much, you know, you have to reconsider your theories. So we're left with the question of where and when did the first heavy elements in the universe get made. But, of course, the implication of finding one really ancient planet is that there were lots of planets around very, very long time ago, which sort of back to the thing I was saying about what do you imagine might happen on an Earth-like planet that got a head start on us by 6, 7, 8 billion years.
And were there other planets that are of that age that no longer exist?
And some planets, right. Some planets are not eternal. Some planets get swallowed by their stars eventually. Other planets get spun off into space. They sort of evaporate into interstellar space. So planets collide and can splinter and shrapnel. Some planets, of course, will live and then die. Some planets never have life. So each planet is going to have a different story. Mm.
And what got you interested in astronomy?
Well, astronomers there's two paths for most of my colleagues. Either you started with small telescopes and trade your way up to the big ones, or you get into it through physics. Now, I grew up a lot early childhood in cities and in the UK, and there's not many stars visible in London and Edinburgh or New York. So
it was the physics route.
So I got in through physics. And most astronomer PhDs probably had their bachelor degree in physics.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Chris Impey today in Radio Times. He is an astronomer. In fact, he's a distinguished professor in the astronomy department at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's on sabbatical at Princeton University, and he's written a new book called How It Began, A Time Traveler's Guide to the Universe. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
I don't feel old. My bones feel old sometimes.
I consider myself a junior senior.
I don't want to fall.
Gray Matters, new tools for growing older. A WHYY Health and Science series starting next week.
Rutgers University in Camden supports WHYY and will host info sessions for graduate programs from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 19th and Tuesday, April 24th. Rutgers Camden offers evening and day graduate programs in such areas as psychology, childhood studies, and social work. Details about the Rutgers Camden graduate info sessions available at camden.rutgers.edu/grad-open-house. Rutgers University in Camden.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Steppin' Out Live with Ben Vereen, April 20th through 22nd. A tribute to Broadway, Frank Sinatra, and Sammy Davis Jr., Steppin' Out Live features classics such as Defying Gravity, My Way, Mr. Bojangles, and Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries. Vereen's performance includes song and dance, stories from his life, and a great deal of humor. For tickets, 215-785-0100 or brtstage.org.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with astronomer Chris Impey. We had talked a little bit about the priest who helped to discover this idea or help create this idea of the Big Bang. You've been working with monks in Tibet. Do I have that right?
It's in northern India. They are Tibetans. They're Tibetan monks in exile, as many of them are. That's an extraordinary thing. I got a call out of the blue a couple of years ago saying, would you like to go to India to teach the Dalai Lama's monks cosmology? It's not the kind of question you follow up with a question. You just say yes.
Absolutely.
And so, of course, I did, and I've been doing it. Actually, just in December, they had a little conference out of that, and I had the amazing privilege of meeting the Dalai Lama, and he introduced our conference. And this is a program that he initiated because he felt he was worried about the Tibetan culture becoming a museum piece. And he was also worried about the monastic tradition not educating his monks for the 21st century, which he thinks is math science is important. So he kick-started some programs to have Western educators working with the monks, teaching them math, science, and I teach the cosmology to them.
And is this in a monastery?
It's a lot of fun because every year it's a different monastery, and so you have to live the life a little bit. You're in a remote part of northern India and usually in a monastery. And, they're just an extraordinary audience. I'm actually writing a book about the experience because it was so singular. They're incredible students. They're totally receptive. They're lighthearted in their approach to the material. They're intense in their dedication to learning. But it's not very competitive, you know. It doesn't have the usual edge.
Is there like the ooh, waving the hands?
Oh, yes, they have the third graders thing of not being able to sit still because they're so excited about what they're hearing or they're so keen to get. Oh, it's an incredible experience, yes.
And they must ask interesting questions.
They ask incredible questions. Just in the discussion we've been having, you know, when I talk about something, they will question the premise. You know, they'll say, well, what is this thing called time that you're measuring when you talk about 13.7 billion year old universe, or they will ask the what came before, or yes. And the interesting thing for people who may be familiar with some of the science religion wars in this country is that there is nothing I've ever presented to them in terms of modern cosmology that's dissonant with their religious tradition. So for Buddhism, all these ideas, the multiverse, life on millions of other planets, 13.7 billion year old universe, whatever you can think of, it fits in their tradition. It's consistent with the ways they might think about things.
And is it quiet?
It's quiet. It's an amazing respite from cell phones. Once in the monastery, there's no traffic. India, of course, is a crazy place in some parts, but these are remote parts of India. So it's a very great place to reflect.
And I assume look up at the sky as well.
Well, yes and no. That was the disappointing part. You're in the foothills of the Himalayas, but in northern India, people burn wood, and so the sky, you know, there's actually a lot of pollutants in the sky.
It's not quite as clear.
It's not the best sky that I've ever seen. No.
But there are the Himalayas, though.
The Himalayas are right there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And how many times have you gone back and forth?
I've done it 4 times now.
Wow. Yeah. Let me get back to our callers. We have, looks like Rob from Norristown joining us on Radio Times. And Rob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call,
you're
Marty.
Welcome.
Dr. Impey, it's such an honor to speak with you. I just have one question. If the universe is dated by treating the current rate of expansion as a constant and then projecting that backwards, and if we now believe that dark energy increases or at least changes the rate of expansion so it's not a constant, has anyone tried to change the projected age of the universe? So maybe it's not 13.7 billion years, maybe it's 20 billion years because at first it was expanding slower, maybe it was only 10 billion years because at first it was expanding faster, and so on.
Right.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah,
yes,
go ahead.
Rob, it's a very good question. And actually, that is exactly what you have to do. Because dark energy slows the expansion rate down and dark energy increases it, you have to take both into account to predict an age. So it turns out that the 13.7 billion years I said and that you would read in a cosmology book take into account both forces. So you're actually doing a calculation based on both of those components. Right. The other thing that's important is you're cross-checking it against observations of what's called the microwave background, which is this radiation relic from the Big Bang. From physics reasons, we know that radiation was generated 400,000 years after the Big Bang, so it's a very short amount of time after the Big Bang. And so we have a benchmark of the very early history to compare to our current age. And so the 13.7 billion years is actually a fairly accurate number. It's accurate to that third, to the second decimal place.
Rob, thanks for the call. Thinking about that moment, you know, right, literally that nanosecond right after the Big Bang, do we know what that was?
I think the physical theory is extremely good back to the first few minutes after the Big Bang, because that's where the helium was produced, and we've measured helium, deuterium, lithium, light elements, and they match perfectly a Big Bang model, so the theory is tested. There's also some verification of the theory back to a microsecond after the Big Bang, which is when the difference between matter and antimatter emerged, because the universe as we see around us is essentially all matter and no antimatter. And yet you can make antimatter in the lab. It's on an equal basis to matter fundamentally. So the theory has some verification back to a microsecond, and then things get a little fuzzy.
Let me see what Lou from Allentown has to say. Hi, Lou. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Quick, easy question. We believe that space is infinite. Am I correct? If not, if it ends, what's on the other side?
Right.
Yeah.
And we've been wrestling with this as cosmologists and astronomers too.
As all the simple questions are the best ones, and that of course is a great question. Because yes, the Greek philosophers worried about this. A colleague of Plato called Archytas said, if I go to the edge of the universe and hurl a swift spear, what do you think? That the spear travels and then into what? Or it hits something and bounces back? So 2,500 years ago, people were asking this question. The cosmologist's answer to the question is that we see no end to space and no boundary. Essentially, and this is an intriguing consequence of the expanding universe, our boundary in viewing is a boundary in time rather than space. So what happens as we look out with this time machine situation is we run out of time rather than space. Right. And so we haven't seen any end or edge to physical space, but as we look back with our telescopes, we reach a point before there were any lights and there's nothing to look at.
Interesting. Lou, thanks for the call. Let me see what looks like Don from Phoenixville has to say. Don, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi there.
There seem to be a number of physical constants that have exactly the values they need to have for there to be atoms and planets and people. And my question is, aside from postulating some intelligence that chose those values, how do we explain that they have these exact particular values?
Thanks, Don.
So, Don, it's a good question, and it's alluding to something that the physicists call fine-tuning and cosmologists sometimes call the anthropic principle. Why are these values such as to allow, for example, intelligent life or stable atoms? Because you could have a physically plausible universe that didn't have atoms in it, and we wouldn't be here, but it's not breaking a law of physics. That is another frontier question. It's very hard to look at the specific circumstance of the universe in a situation where we don't have a fundamental theory of matter. So we have no unified theory of the four forces at the moment. And then say why the four forces had the values they are or the physical constants had the values they do. So I think, unfortunately, it's very hard to argue for some specialness about us or our circumstance based on that. It's more likely that there's a fundamental theory we're still reaching towards out of which the values would make sense. They'd be interpreted in terms of a theory we don't have in our possession yet. So that's why we have to keep going with our theorizing.
Don, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Are astronomers optimists by nature, do you think?
I think they have to be because, you know, the questions they're dealing with are not always resolvable in their lifetime, so they have to feel optimistic about the process. I mean, you have to enjoy the journey because you may not get to the destination, which is knowing everything or having figured it all out. And even astronomers don't find the sort of vastness and inhospitability of most of the universe to be a deterrent. They think that the universe is probably filled with life, and that's an exciting and interesting possibility. And that even though our star will go out and the Earth's biosphere will have its time, they think there's durability even on our planet.
But I'm also thinking, even in terms of body language, and I know that, you know, you're looking at telescopes, so you might be looking down, but the idea of looking up,
right?
You know, you're orienting yourself sort of up, and optimistically, I would think.
I think it's optimistic because it has an irrelevance to the human condition. Astronomy is not going to solve some of the world's most pressing problems, and that's just in the nature of the enterprise. But it's also optimistic because it's saying that us, as denizens of a small planet, have in our heads the ability to understand something vast compared to us and make sense of it. And that's sort of an optimistic statement about our capabilities.
Have you ever wanted to travel into space?
Oh, sure.
Or deep space, perhaps?
Oh, most astronomers wanted to do that. I was a postdoc when the Shuttle Challenger blew up, and a terrible, somber moment for everyone. And I was in a room in a lounge at Caltech with a lot of astronomers, and after the this moment of silence almost, someone said, okay, the NASA administrator calls tomorrow and offers you a free ride. The thing's just blown up and killed everyone aboard. Would you go? Everyone in the room said they would go, including me. So most of the people in my game are, gung-ho on space. We'd love to try it if we could.
And is there a question that has haunted you for a lot of your astronomer life?
Well, actually, the last caller alludes to a question that is kind of intriguing, which is, why is the universe constructed in such a way as to allow intelligent life to exist? Because it didn't have to be that way. Mm-hmm. And that's almost a philosophical question, but it's one that bothers a lot of astronomers. It feels like we're missing a big piece of some puzzle.
Bother because here we are.
Exactly.
Right? And how did we get here?
Right. So it's a very deep base level of explaining why we're here. Not the explaining how did life form on Earth and so on, but how did it even become possible for life to be on Earth and us to be here?
And for us to be sitting in this room with microphones dangling
and
talking.
It gets very specific.
It does. It does. But the Earth has been referred to as a Goldilocks planet. I mean, do you buy into that? Not too hot, not too cold?
Right. I don't believe that. And mostly I don't believe that because life on Earth is incredibly robust. Life is found in deep sea trenches and superheated water and Antarctic valleys. So life exists in an enormous range of physical conditions, and that's just our planet. I imagine that other planets with other physical conditions would have life that had adapted to their to their range.
Let me get, looks like Larry from Phoenixville to join us. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I just wanted to follow up with the idea of infinite. So if we're not sure about the outer edge of the universe, when you talk about expanding, are you talking about things within the universe just expanding away from each other, or are you theorizing that possibly the outer edge is expanding the universe as a whole?
Okay, there's a good point that I can make out of that good question, which is the Big Bang model involves such rapid expansion that we know there are regions of physical space we've never observed with our telescopes, because essentially they were carried away from each other faster than the speed of light earlier in the history of the universe. Now, there's a theory that nothing travels faster than light, but that's Einstein's special theory. His general theory, which governs the universe, expansion, has no speed limit. And so the Big Bang theory itself contains within it the idea that the physical universe, all that there is bigger, vastly bigger possibly, than the observable universe, all we can see.
Interesting. Larry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And has Hubble, I mean, there, and you have some pictures of some telescopes in here, has Hubble really been the telescope that has helped us to open up our understanding of the universe?
Yeah, Hubble
led the way in a way.
After its somewhat ignominious start with the bad optics and top 10 excuses on David Letterman and so on, Hubble's had a very great run for a few decades. Hubble sees deeper and further than any other telescope so far, and it's taken this story, this time travel story, back as close to the Big Bang as any optical telescope can. And it's worth remembering that Hubble, if you put it in a list of the world's largest telescopes, it doesn't actually get into the top 50.
Really?
We have much, much bigger telescopes on the ground. Hubble does what it does by the space environment, which is why astronomers really still need space telescopes, even though we have much bigger ones on the ground.
You have a picture of one, and I don't even know how to describe it. It looks like a gigantic donut.
Oh, yeah. We have, under our football stadium at the University of Arizona, we make huge mirrors. Roger Angel runs a mirror lab, and they make 8.4-meter diameter mirrors, the biggest mirrors ever made by anyone. And we've done it now multiple times.
Wow.
And they're vast. They're huge. So these are things almost as big as bigger than your living room and slightly smaller than your house. They're huge mirrors, incredibly accurate surfaces. A mirror that size, if you expanded it to the size of the United States, the biggest blemishes on it were an inch high. So it's an incredibly accurate mirror, and we make them in a big rotating oven under our football stadium stand.
Oh my goodness, that's fantastic. Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
I've enjoyed it a lot. Thanks, Marty.
I've enjoyed us as well. And again, Chris Impey has been our guest. He's a professor in the astronomy department at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He has a new book called How It Began, A Time Traveler's Guide to the Universe, a companion to a previous book titled How It Ends. And we do appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also check us out online. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can follow us on Twitter and check us out on Facebook and send us an email as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Emily Bryant is the Radio Times intern, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we do want to close things out with a song by the Bare Naked Ladies, and it's called The Big Bang Theory. Let's listen.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, the Earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall. We built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery, it all started with a Big Bang. Hey! Since the dawn of man is really not that long, as every galaxy was formed in less time than it takes to sing this song. A fraction of a second and the elements were made. The bipeds stood up straight, the dinosaurs all met their fate. They tried to leap but they were late and they all died. They closed their asses off the oceans and Pangea. See, a wooden bottom be set in motion by the same Big Bang. It all started with a Big Bang. It's expanding ever outward, but one day
well, we could.